waddled across the gym. I wanted to make her an offer. How about I tell Lupe not to come next week since you're going to be on vacation and we just call it a day? During that same year, I was asked to speak about my homeland to a 7th grade class at my school. The girl who had asked me was a neighbor who needed some extra credit in social studies. I showed up complete with my books in Persian, a doll depicting a villager weaving a Persian rug, several Persian miniatures, and some stuffed grape leaves, courtesy of my mother. I stood in front of the class and said, "Hello, my name is Firuzeh, and I'm from Iran." Before I could say anything else, the teacher stood up and said, "Laura, you said she's from Peru." If my life were a Hollywood musical, this would have been the beginning of the big dance number. You say tomato, I say tomato. You say Persia, I say Peru. Let's call the whole thing off. So home I went with my Persian miniatures, my doll depicting a villager weaving a Persian rug, and my books. At least my mother didn't have to cook dinner that night since the 30 grape leaves were enough for all of us. During our stay in Newport Beach, the Iranian Revolution took place, and a group of Americans were taken hostage in the American Embassy in Tehran. Overnight, Iranians living in America became, to say the least, very unpopular. For some reason, many Americans began to think that all Iranians, despite outward appearances to the contrary, could at any given moment get angry and take prisoners. People always asked us what we thought of the hostage situation. "It's awful," we always said. This reply was generally met with surprise. We were asked our opinion on the hostages so often that I started reminding people that they weren't in our garage. My mother solved the problem by claiming to be from Russia or Turkey. Sometimes I'd just say, "Have you noticed how all the recent serial killers have been Americans? I won't hold it against you." From Newport Beach, I moved to Berkeley, a town once described as the armpit of California. But Berkeley wasn't just any armpit. It was an armpit in need of a shave and a shower, an armpit full of well-read people who had not only heard of Iran, but knew something about it. In Berkeley, people were either thrilled or horrified to meet an Iranian. Reactions included, "So what do you think of the fascist American CIA pigs who supported the Shah's dictatorship, only to use him as a puppet in their endless thirst for power in the Middle East and other areas like Nicaragua?" Sometimes mentioning that I was from Iran completely ended the conversation. I never knew why, but I assume some feared that I might really be yet another female terrorist masquerading as a history of art major at UC Berkeley. My favorite category of question, however, assumed that all Iranians were really just one big family. "Do you know Ali Akbari in Cincinnati?" people would ask. "He's so nice." During my years at Berkeley, I met François, a Frenchman who later became my husband. It was during our friendship that I realized how unfair my life had truly been. Being French in America is like having your hand stamped with one of those passes that allows you to get into everything. All François has to do is mention his obviously French name, and people find him intriguing. It is assumed that he's a sensitive, well-read intellectual, someone who, when not reciting Baudelaire, spends his days creating impressionist paintings. Every American seems to have a favorite France story. "It was the loveliest café, and I can still taste the tartatin." As far as I know, François had not made that tartatin, although people are more than happy to give him credit. "You know," I always add, "France has an ugly colonial past." But it doesn't matter. People see my husband and think of Gene Kelly dancing with Leslie Caron. People see me and think of hostages. This is why in my next life, I'm applying to come back as a Swede. I assume that as a Swede, I will be a leggy blonde. Should God get things confused and send me back as a Swede trapped in the body of a Middle Eastern woman, I'll just pretend I'm French. A dozen keychains. In my large extended family, each member has a reputation. This reputation, carved in stone, is usually the result of a somewhat random act that for some unknown reason takes on a far greater meaning and becomes the defining moment in a life. At the tender age of 5, for instance, my cousin Ardashir developed the nasty habit of defecating behind his parents' living room curtains during their frequent formal dinner parties. Today, someone might interpret this behavior as a sign of anger, since the poor tot was stuck with a nanny against his wishes while the other family members reveled. Instead, it came to serve as a reflection of the type of person he really is. having outgrown his annoying and unique routine, Adeshi went on to become a restaurant owner. Recently, at a family gathering that took place during a slow patch in his otherwise successful career, someone mentioned that Adeshi's restaurant wasn't doing too well. To this, my aunt replied, "Well, what do you expect from someone who poops behind curtains?" As much as Adeshi has suffered from his reputation, my older brother Fashid continues to thrive on his. When Fashid was in kindergarten back in Abadan, he was, according to all reports, an extremely popular and charismatic little person. This may not seem like such a big deal in other families, but my parents, both of whom are painfully shy, looked upon their outgoing anomaly just as Native Americans regard an albino buffalo. He was a miracle. 40 years after completing kindergarten, my brother is still consulted before all decisions, big or small. Fashid has steered endless number of cousins and second cousins through decisions ranging from which type of car to buy, to which courses to take in college, to which nasal decongestant works best. Nobody is more devoted to Fashid's decision-making prowess than my parents, and Fashid, like James Bond, has never turned down an assignment. When I was 11 years old, I told my parents I wanted to go to camp. The year was 1976, and I had lived in America for a total of 2 years. Except for some sleepovers back in second grade, I had never spent the night away from my parents. I cannot remember what possessed me to want to try summer camp. I'm not sure I even knew what one did at camp. But for whatever reason, I made the announcement, and my parents immediately assigned Fashid, who was then 18, the task of finding the right camp for me. After much research, Fashid found the perfect camp, Pine Lodge Mountain Summer Camp, located in the Mammoth Mountains, a mere 8-hour drive from my house. My father, whose cult-like devotion to Fashid rules out the possibility of questioning any of Fashid's decisions, was very impressed that the camp cost $500 for 2 weeks. "Anything that expensive has to be good," he repeatedly said. The Pine Lodge brochure also came with a stamp of approval from a camp organization that none of us had ever heard of, but which further impressed my father. My mother, as usual, had no comment, although 20 years later she did say, "I didn't think you should have gone." After signing up for Pine Lodge Mountain Summer Camp, I received a list of supplies I would need, none of which we owned. The following Saturday, my father and I set out for Montgomery Ward. My father, whose aversion to shopping is well known, believes that anything that costs more than it did back in Ahvaz in 1946 is overpriced. Fortunately, he is always willing to pay for classes and experiences that promote growth of some sort, but everything else is too expensive. His inability to pay full price for anything explains why he owns what is, as far as we know, the only maroon and pink suede pair of Nikes in existence. The items he has picked up on clearance tables range from merely useless, like his portable siren, to truly atrocious, like birds made of felt. And even he has admitted that people do stare at his maroon Nikes in a way that suggests something other than envy. But the magnetic pull of a bargain is simply too strong. List in hand, my father and I headed straight for the clearance section in the camping department. The first item on our list was a sleeping bag. Unfortunately for me, there happened to be one on sale. Although I knew nothing about sleeping bags, I did notice that this one was considerably larger and bulkier than the ones not on sale. While the others rolled up and fit neatly into small drawstring bags, this one was the size of our kitchen table, which my father had bought at an auction of seized goods. I did point out to my father that this particular sleeping bag did not come with a drawstring bag. My father assured me that he would find some kind of bag at home. After all, you'd have to be stupid to pass up a sleeping bag that cost only $8.99. We continued down the list and purchased the cheapest version of everything, skipping the optional items entirely. Those, my father explained, were for people who just like to buy stuff. Inflatable mattress, wide-brimmed hat, insect repellent. Who needed all that extra baggage? We brought home our purchases and proceeded to examine each object as if it were a meteor that had landed in our living room. A mesh bag for laundry, stackable tin plates that converted to frying pans, an aluminum canteen with a built-in cup. These purchases, coupled with a picture of the smiling girl riding a horse on the camp brochure, left little doubt in my mind that Pine Lodge Mountain Summer Camp meant nonstop fun and adventure. The only doubt lingering in my mind concerned the sleeping bag. Despite my father's reassurance, there existed no bag in our house big enough to hold this monstrosity. No matter how much my brother, father, and I sat on the sleeping bag, we could not make it less bulky. It defied flattening. The synthetic material used to stuff my sleeping bag would have been much better utilized in some other place, like freeway dividers. But for now, I was stuck with the King Kong of all sleeping bags and nothing to put it in. Finally, my father, with his mind of an engineer, came up with a brilliant solution, a hefty trash bag. A few months later, my father and I drove to the bus stop together. Like any other child going to overnight camp for the first time, I immediately regretted my decision. My father did his best to calm me by telling me stories of his first year in America as a Fulbright scholar at Texas A&M. He spoke fondly of his Pakistani roommate who made delicious curry, but whose name he no longer remembered. My father's stories made one fact abundantly clear. I did not want to go to camp. We arrived at the bus stop only to discover that all the other kids had signed up with at least one friend. My family had just moved from Whittier to Newport Beach, so I didn't have a friend anywhere, especially at this bus stop. To make matters worse, everyone was staring at my hefty trash bag. We finally boarded the bus. I sat by myself and secretly wished that some kind person would sit next to me and be my friend. No one sat next to me. As the bus ride began, I was acutely aware of how much fun all the kids around me seemed to be having. Giggles and laughter filled the bus. After a few hours on the road, the boy behind me tapped me on the shoulder. "Hey, can I ask you a question?" he said. "Sure," I answered. "Well," he said, "do you look down a lot?"
"No, why?" I asked.
"Well, your nose points downward, so I figured that's because you're always looking at the ground or something."
Upon hearing this, all the kids around me burst out laughing. Hours later, we arrived at camp. Pine Lodge was a converted two-story house. All the boys stayed downstairs, and all the girls stayed on the second floor. In the girls' room stood rows of bunk beds. There was one bathroom on the floor for all the girls to share. Oddly, the door to the bathroom had been removed, so any girl who needed to use the toilet or the sink could walk in on someone taking a shower. Coming from a modest culture and an even more modest family, I had never seen another person naked, not even my mother. So the idea that someone could walk into the bathroom while I was naked in the shower seemed unbelievable. I decided then and there not to bathe. Out of the 11 other girls in my room, 10 appeared to be mean. Mary, who slept on the top of my bunk, was the only girl who would speak to me, or rather cry to me. I liked her right away, not as a friend, but as someone who made me look good. Mary and her younger brother, Willie, were both campers, and they spent all day trying to be on the same team for all activities, and all night crying at the idea of being separated. I had never known a brother and sister who actually enjoyed each other's company so much. I soon discovered it wasn't that they enjoyed each other's company so much as they were simply afraid of everybody else. The two of them managed to be the butt of every joke. Mary felt responsible for Willie, whose Coke bottle glasses and tendency to tremble made him an easy target for all the boys. Mary herself was not much more resilient. All someone had to do to reduce her to tears was to call her a name, any name. Mary and Willie were a huge source of comfort to me, not only because they hated Pine Lodge Mountain Summer Camp as much as I did, but because they were the ones whom everyone picked on. I knew that in the pecking order of favorite targets for mean kids, I followed Mary and her brother. But those two, between their crying, their trembling, and their throwing up when nervous, proved far more satisfying targets than I could have ever hoped to be. In fact, not only did I not get picked on, but I was completely ignored by everyone, including the counselors. Had it not been for Mary sobbing to me every night, I could have sworn I was at a Zen retreat. Since I wasn't going to bathe, I decided to minimize getting dirty by participating only in arts and crafts. I skipped the horseback riding, the overnight campout, the archery lessons, the hikes to the Indian grounds, and basically every activity outlined in the camp brochure. Every morning, I showed up at the macrame station ready to make another keychain. At the end of the first week, the counselors announced that the camp would be putting on a play called Fiddler on the Roof, and everyone would have to participate. Each camper was assigned a role. I was to play the ghost of the grandmother. Even though I had only one line, the role required that I be covered head to toe with talcum powder. I now suspect that this was a ploy to encourage me to bathe. The night of the play, one of the counselors started to apply the talcum powder, but soon ran into a problem. A week's worth of oil had accumulated on my hair and body, and the talcum powder clumped the instant it touched me. Rather than look like a ghost, I resembled someone who'd been dunked in a vat of bread dough. After the play, I really wanted to bathe, but I simply could not. The idea of any of the mean girls walking in on me as I took a shower was just too much. Plus, I had achieved such a near-invisible status, I didn't think anyone would notice how dirty I was. Nobody, except for the macrame teacher Pat, ever talked to me, so I had no motivation to risk humiliation in exchange for hygiene. Finally, the last day of camp arrived. I put on the one clean t-shirt I had saved for this day, packed my 12 keychains, rolled the sleeping bag into its trash bag, and waited for the bus. I didn't have to worry about any emotional goodbyes, since this was by far my happiest day at camp. I exchanged addresses only with Pat. I didn't have much to say to Mary, since our relationship was based entirely on her sobbing and my listening. I wondered whether her father would be angry if he'd learned he had spent $1,000 on camp for his kids, and they had done nothing but cry. I at least had my keychains, and by the second week, even Pat had remarked on the quality of my knots. I arrived at the bus station to find my father and oldest brother Farid waiting for me. Upon seeing me, Farid screamed, "You stink! Didn't you bathe at all?" All of a sudden, I realized the gravity of the situation. I had not washed my body in 2 weeks. Having lost my near-invisible camp status, I was overcome with embarrassment and shame. "Of course I bathed," I replied. During the car ride back, my father asked me if I had enjoyed camp. "It was great," I said. I knew he had sent me to camp, expecting $500 worth of fun, and I didn't have the heart to tell him the truth. So instead of weaving keychains, I spent the next few weeks weaving stories of all my great adventures. I don't know whether my father believed me, but at least I earned the reputation as the best keychain maker in the family. You can call me Al. My father's favorite spot on planet Earth is Las Vegas. As a child, I had to endure endless vacations to that Den o' Sin in the desert. Whenever a 3 or 4 day weekend rolled around, my father would happily announce, "We're going to Las Vegas." I hated it, but Las Vegas was cheap, and so was my father, so off we went. Las Vegas was a 4 hour drive from our house. The highway leading to this promised land cut through the desert, which meant that watching the scenery from the back seat of our Chevrolet rivaled the thrill of watching a fishing show. My brothers, both of them in college, were spared these trips. I envied them. The ritual was always the same. We would have to wake up by 5 a.m. so we could be on the road by 5:15. The day before our trip, the gas tank was filled, the engine checked, the suitcases packed, and the windshield cleaned, all courtesy of my father. The most important part of our ritual involved my mother's holding the Quran at the top of the door frame while we each walked under it. For my parents, this ensured a safe journey. They hoped one without speeding tickets. I always found it unsettling to invoke religion in anything having to do with Las Vegas, a place that I'm quite sure the Prophet Muhammad would not have approved of. We always drove for 1 hour before stopping for breakfast at Denny's. My father's devotion to Denny's restaurants approached religious fervor. To him, Denny's was a clean oasis where the waitresses were always friendly. We didn't really like the food, but that seemed like a small price to pay for a clean bathroom in the middle of the desert. After breakfast, we'd get back in the car, turn on the air conditioner, and keep driving. We didn't stop until the next Denny's, where we'd have a snack, and my father would say how amazing it was that all Denny's could be so clean no matter where they were. America is a great country, he'd always add. Once we reached Las Vegas, we always went to the Stardust. There, my father would go to the front desk and ask for a special friend, a man who had asked to be called Al. Despite the no vacancy sign, the mighty Al would get us a room. This clandestine operation, however, required a handshake with a $5 bill enclosed. My father loved his Frank Sinatra moment and always told stories about the exchanges between him and Al, stretching a 5-minute encounter into a 2-hour story. I hated Al and always hoped he'd end up in jail. But he, like the decks of cards adorned with pictures of naked women, was a fixture at the Stardust. Years later, I asked my father why he never made room reservations in advance. That would have been too boring, he said. Once we settled into our room, my father headed straight for the blackjack tables. Everyone, except gamblers, knows that gambling never pays. My father always believed that he was this close to the big one. But because of some unforeseen event, like someone else winning, he'd lost. Losing, like winning, only increased his determination to play. At the blackjack table, my father became strangely superstitious, blaming his losses on seemingly unrelated events. He never sat at a table where anyone wore a hat, since that was bad luck. Redheads were good luck, but only if they were women. Redheaded men were bad luck. People who talked too much were bad luck, as were people who were strangely silent. My favorite of his wacky beliefs was that non-Americans at the table were bad luck. I couldn't resist suggesting that maybe he should stay home, since as a foreigner, he was his own biggest source of bad luck. My father never appreciated that observation. A few hours after our arrival, my mother would declare that it was time to go find my father. Minors were not allowed in the gambling area, so like moons orbiting the earth, we circled the perimeter of the casino, looking for my father's signature receding hairline. During our many revolutions, we noticed a correlation between receding hairlines and blackjack, as well as a relationship between outdated bouffant hairdos and slot machines. Once we'd spotted him, I'd wait near the main entrance while my mother went to fetch him. My father considered the sight of my mother approaching him to be a certain sign of bad luck. It was then time for the $3.99 all-you-can-eat buffet, during which we unfortunately had to listen to my father's gambling stories. These didn't change much from trip to trip and involved a lot of almosts. I hated these stories as much as I hated Al, because I had figured out that nobody leaves Las Vegas a winner. The all-you-can-eat buffet, that American phenomenon, represented the only endurance exercise at which my family excelled. Even when my father had just lost hundreds of dollars at the blackjack table, we felt that we were beating the system by filling ourselves with more food than we were actually paying for. "These shrimp alone are worth at least $5," my father would declare. "Look at those desserts. They're worth the price of the buffet by themselves," my mom and I would chime in. By stuffing ourselves until we ached, we felt we had outsmarted Las Vegas, and all for only $3.99. What made Las Vegas even more awful were my memories of real vacations we had taken in the past. In Iran, vacation meant going to the Caspian Sea. Every summer, my father's employer, the National Iranian Oil Company, allowed its employees the use of its villas in Mahmudabad for 1 week. Mahmudabad, a town on the Caspian shore, was a 2-day drive from Abadan. Every summer, the five of us would pile into our Chevrolet, my mom making sure to bring enough sandwiches, cucumbers, fruit, and Coca-Cola for the long drive. We were always glad to leave Abadan in the summer, since its desert climate was unbearable. As we headed north toward Tehran, the weather cooled off slowly, proof that we were indeed farther and farther from our home. We always reached Tehran in the evening and spent the night at relatives' houses. The next morning, we set off again, complete with fresh sandwiches and fruit, courtesy of my relatives. The drive between Tehran and the Caspian Sea is one of the most beautiful stretches of land I have ever seen. The lush scenery offered more shades of green than I saw anywhere else. We passed by endless fields of purple wildflowers. The most exciting part of the trip was the many tunnels, which enabled us to pass through the Alborz Mountains to reach the Caspian. We knew we were almost there by the change in the climate. The closer we came, the fresher and crisper the air. The sight of villagers hawking cheap plastic pails, beach balls, and shell necklaces along the road meant one thing. We were almost at the sea. We could no longer contain our excitement. The villas we stayed in were modest cabins lined up along the beach like dominoes. Days were spent at the beach where we built sandcastles, looked for seashells, and played in the waves. Knowing the children were safely occupied, my parents relaxed and mingled with friends. Meals were eaten in the mess hall, cafeteria style. At night, everyone returned to the cafeteria for the nightly movie. In retrospect, our vacation was like a family camp, and everyone was sad to leave. "How can a week go by so quickly?" we'd always ask. In America, we lived on the California coast, but rarely went to the beach. The water was too cold and the waves too big. Longing for warm water one year, we decided to vacation in Hawaii. My father booked a one-week stay in Waikiki. "We're staying right on the beach," he announced. Having never been to Hawaii, I expected a relaxing tropical paradise, somewhere like Gilligan's Island. We arrived in Waikiki to discover that an ocean view room meant we had to stand on our balcony and crane our necks to catch a speck of blue in the far corner. In between the high-rises sat shops declaring, "I got laid in Hawaii," on t-shirts, mugs, and towels. Everywhere I went, I saw the same carved coconuts, the same seashell frames, and the same hats, all made in the Philippines. I tried to hang loose, but Waikiki felt more like 7-Eleven by the sea. The following year, we decided to vacation on Kauai, an island in Hawaii that the travel agent described as a true tropical paradise. The description was accurate. Our one-story hotel sat in the middle of a lush forest. On our first day, we experienced quick tropical rains followed by spectacular rainbows. Vibrant flowers, so big and rich in color that they almost looked fake, dotted the plants around our hotel. We had found God's hideaway. On our second day, my parents announced that Kauai was boring. "There's nothing to look at, just plants and rainbows," my father declared. "There are no stores," added my mother. Instead of staying for another week, we left the next day. The following year, my father decided to take us to Yosemite National Park for a week. Uncle Nematola was staying with us then. My father booked two cabins, and off we went for another taste of paradise. 8 hours later, we arrived in the beautiful Yosemite Valley. We oohed and awed at the spectacular scenery. The first day, we explored the surrounding area, wading in a nearby stream. All was perfect until my uncle, who didn't speak English but who could nonetheless identify a picture of a bear's head with a line through it, asked my father to translate the signs posted near our cabin. My father explained that the signs warned campers of bears that often came looking for food. Upon hearing this, my mother and uncle decided we had to leave Yosemite right away. My mother was convinced that the bears were lined up in the nearby bushes waiting for their chance at the all-you-can-eat Persian buffet. "We can't leave," I protested. "We just got here." My mother was already packing the suitcases. I tried my best to reason with her. "The signs say that the bears are attracted by the smell of food, not people." An hour later, we were in the car, headed for the bear-free suburbs. After that trip, my father declared that with the sole exception of Las Vegas, his favorite vacation spot was right here on the sofa in front of the television set. My mother declared that my father was a bore, and I decided that as soon as I was grown up, I would travel the world looking for rainbows and bears. But before that, I'd have to see Al one more time so I could suggest a great vacation spot for him. "Just keep plenty of food on you at all times," I'd tell him, "especially when you sleep." Of mosquitoes and men. My husband Francois loves to travel. When I first met him, he regaled me with stories of exotic places he had visited. The Maldive Islands, West Africa, Bali, Sri Lanka. He told me stories about his Greek grandfather, Savas, who traveled to Baghdad to set up the city's first leavened bread factory. A few months after his arrival, he suffered a minor cut during his daily shave. The seemingly innocuous cut became infected. Penicillin had not yet reached Baghdad, and Savas died a few days later, leaving behind a wife and two young daughters. In keeping with local tradition, Savas was buried in a Muslim ceremony. A few nights later, François's Belgian grandmother, Octavie, went to the gravesite at midnight with two young men, a Roman Catholic priest, and a shovel. She had her husband dug up, then reburied in a Catholic ceremony. Before Baghdad, Savas and Octavie had lived in the Congo, where Octavie had a beloved baby buffalo. This gentle creature hung around their home like a family pet. But like all buffalo, he eventually grew big and turned into the proverbial bull in the china shop. Having been domesticated, he could no longer be returned to the wild, so Octavie decided to send him to the zoo in Antwerp. After a teary goodbye, she placed the buffalo on a steamship bound for Belgium. But alas, the zoo never received its newest addition. Somewhere between the Congo and Belgium, the cook had developed a hankering for buffalo stew. François also told me that when he first attended kindergarten in Paris, his teacher called his parents after a week to inform them that their son was exhibiting inappropriate behavior and needed to see a psychologist immediately. Apparently, François was unable to keep his clothes on at school. His mother had to explain that having spent his formative years in Africa, he wasn't used to wearing clothes. Given time, she said, he would surely adjust. I loved all of François' stories and never had to impress him with any exotic tales, since as far as he was concerned, being Iranian and having a name like Firouzeh far outweighed any of his adventures. I didn't quite agree with him, but who was I to burst the bubble of a man whom I had somehow managed to effortlessly impress? A man who was captivated by the mere details of my life. Every so often, I would toss out some piddly story about the caviar vendors beside the Caspian Sea, or the smell of nasturtiums in my Aunt Sadira's garden, and the Frenchman went gaga. By the time I told him about the frog infestation in Ahvaz, he wanted to marry me. All was well until we started to plan our honeymoon. François had told me that he wanted to take me to the most romantic place on earth. That sounded good. We're going to go to a former palace, he had continued. Was this really my life, or had I, through some wrinkle in time, stepped into somebody else's universe, like maybe Grace Kelly's? But like every good fantasy, this one lasted about 30 seconds. That's when François told me that this romantic getaway was in India. I tried to conceal my shock, but for me, India and honeymoon just didn't belong in the same sentence. As much as I love Indian music, literature, and food, I had never felt the need to go there on my honeymoon. I feel about India the way I feel while watching those Jacques Cousteau adventures where the divers explore undersea caves, flashing their lights in the pitch-black crevices, only to discover that the cave is teeming with sharks and giant squid. Yes, it's breathtaking, but from my sofa. Do I want to don a wetsuit and join Jacques in those frigid waters? No merci. François was very disappointed that several weeks of planning had been met with, "Are you kidding?" I tried to explain to him that for me, a vacation does not involve certain hardships, including, but not limited to, mosquitoes, vaccinations, poor plumbing, or stomach ailments. Having grown up in southern Iran, I experienced enough physical discomforts to make me truly appreciate a nice resort. François's life of affluence in the Parisian suburbs, on the other hand, had left him itching for adventure. The only itching I felt was caused by the constant mosquito bites I got in Abadan. To François's family, a vacation meant going to their secluded seaside villa in Greece, where they brushed up on their tanning and windsurfing skills. These activities were interspersed with fishing or looking for ancient relics that washed up on the beach. To my family, a vacation usually meant going to a relative's house and sleeping on the floor, squeezed between several cousins. François enjoyed traveling through Greece on rickety buses, such a refreshing contrast to the orderly and predictable Parisian metro. I had to ride a similar bus to school in fourth grade, and I found it neither quaint nor charming. Ignoring any notions of safety, the bus driver packed in twice as many kids as seats. Since I was one of the last to be picked up, I had to stand in the aisle, squeezed between the other kids like an egg in a tightly packed tin of beluga caviar. One day, the girl behind me threw up all over me on the way to school. The driver kept driving. By the time I reached school, I was in tears, but the teacher would not let me go home. I had to spend the entire day with dried vomit all over my uniform while all the kids around me held their noses. During other vacations, Francois saw the sights in Thailand and Bali, the only sights we ever chose to see were the faces of family members who lived in other towns. Francois's family thought large bugs and humidity were exotic. We worshipped the guys who invented climate control and bug spray. We never sought exotic forms of discomfort. They were part of a package deal that came with our homeland. I remember being 5 years old and going to the bazaar in Abadan with my mother and needing desperately to go to the bathroom. The only bathrooms available were Turkish ones, which consist of a hole in the ground. If odor could be measured in decibels, these toilets were the equivalent of front row seats at a heavy metal concert. Needless to say, I just couldn't get myself to use any of them. Besides setting a bladder endurance record, I learned never to drink anything on the morning of bazaar day. As much as I loved living in Abadan, I hated the heat and the mosquitoes. If everyone has a lifetime quota of bug bites, I reached mine by age 6. My father used to tell me that I must be the sweetest person because the mosquitoes bit me more than anyone else. The constant itching combined with the oppressive heat made me truly appreciate modern touches like powerful air conditioners and screen doors. When we came to California, one of the first things I noticed was the pleasant absence of mosquitoes. After almost 2 delightful mosquito-free years in Whittier, we returned to Iran. My mother and I went to live in Ahvaz with my aunt Fatimeh, while my father worked in Tehran. Ahvaz in southern Iran is a town generously endowed with dirt and dust. Everything that moved on the unpaved streets, whether people, donkeys, or cars, only served to relocate the dirt from the ground to the face of anyone who happened to be walking down the same path. It rarely rained, but when it did, the dirt became mud, and mud on the face is far more annoying than dirt. I was slow to adjust to my new, more physically challenging surroundings. Just when I was getting used to the taste of dust in my mouth, along came a frog infestation of biblical proportions. Tiny frogs covered the town. The streets undulated under a blanket of frogs. Before we entered any building, we had to scrape off the layer of sticky frog guts clinging to our shoes. No matter how quickly we opened and closed the front door of our house, 5 or 6 frogs managed to hop in. We always found the intruders eventually, but in the most unlikely places. I never quite got used to hearing my mother scream, "How did the frog get in there?" This went on for a couple of weeks until the frogs mysteriously disappeared and frog innards were, thankfully, no longer a part of my daily life. The next time I saw frogs close up, I was on my honeymoon in Paris. Francois and I were staying in a beautiful hotel with great plumbing and no mosquitoes. This time, the frogs were not covering the bottom of my shoe, but instead were covered with a light persillade and came with a side of asparagus. They were much better that way. The F word. My cousin's name, Farbod, means greatness. When he moved to America, all the kids called him Farthead. My brother, Farshid, he who enlightens, became Fartshit. The name of my friend Negar means beloved, although it can be more accurately translated as she whose name almost incites riots. Her brother, Arash, giver, initially couldn't understand why every time he'd say his name, people would laugh and ask him if it itched. All of us immigrants knew that moving to America would be fraught with challenges, but none of us thought that our names would be such an obstacle. How could our parents have ever imagined that someday we would end up in a country where monosyllabic names reign supreme, a land where William is shortened to Bill, where Susan becomes Sue, and Richard somehow evolves into Dick. America is a great country, but nobody without a mask and a cape has a Z in his name. And have Americans ever realized the great scope of the guttural sounds they're missing? Okay, so it has to do with linguistic roots, but I do believe this would be a richer country if all Americans could do a little tongue aerobics and learn to pronounce ch, a sound more commonly associated in this culture with phlegm, or q, the sound usually made by actors in the final moments of a choking scene. It's like adding a few new spices to the kitchen pantry. Move over cinnamon and nutmeg. Make way for cardamom and somal. Exotic analogies aside, having a foreign name in this land of Joes and Marys is a pain in the spice cabinet. When I was 12, I decided to simplify my life by adding an American middle name. This decision serves as proof that sometimes simplifying one's life in the short run only complicates it in the long run. My name, Firuze, chosen by my mother, means turquoise in Persian. In America, it means unpronounceable, or I'm not going to talk to you because I cannot possibly learn your name and I just don't want to have to ask you again and again because you'll think I'm dumb or you might get upset or something. My father, incidentally, had wanted to name me Sarah. I do wish he had won that argument. To strengthen my decision to add an American name, I had just finished fifth grade in Whittier, where all the kids incessantly called me ferocious. That summer, my family moved to Newport Beach, where I looked forward to starting a new life. I wanted to be a kid with a name that didn't draw so much attention, a name that didn't come with a built-in inquisition as to when and why I had moved to America, and how was it that I spoke English without an accent, and was I planning on going back, and what did I think of America? My last name didn't help any. I can't mention my maiden name because, Dad, I'm writing a memoir. Great, just don't mention our name. Suffice it to say that with 8 letters, including a Z and 4 syllables, my last name is as difficult and foreign as my first. My first and last name together generally serve the same purpose as a high brick wall. There was one exception to this rule. In Berkeley, and only in Berkeley, my name drew people like flies to baklava. These were usually people named Amaryllis or Chrysanthemum, types who vacationed in Costa Rica, and to whom lentils described a type of burger. These folks were probably not the pride of Poughkeepsie, but they were refreshingly non-judgmental. When I announced to my family that I wanted to add an American name, they reacted with their usual laughter. Never one to let mockery or good judgment stand in my way, I proceeded to ask for suggestions. My father suggested Fifi. Had I had a special affinity for French poodles or been considering a career in prostitution, I would have gone with that one. My mom suggested Farah, a name easier than Firuze, yet still Iranian. Her reasoning made sense, except that Farah Fawcett was at the height of her popularity, and I didn't want to be associated with somebody whose poster hung in every post-pubescent boy's bedroom. We couldn't think of any American names beginning with F, so we moved on to J, the first letter of our last name. I don't know why we limited ourselves to names beginning with my initials, but it made sense at that moment, perhaps by the logic employed moments before bungee jumping. I finally chose the name Julie, mainly for its simplicity. My brothers, Farid and Fashid, thought that adding an American name was totally stupid. They later became Fred and Sean. That same afternoon, our doorbell rang. It was our new next-door neighbor, a friendly girl my age named Julie. She asked me my name, and after a moment of hesitation, I introduced myself as Julie. "What a coincidence," she said. I didn't explain that I had been Julie for only half an hour. Thus, I started sixth grade with my new, easy name, and life became infinitely simpler. People actually remembered my name, which was an entirely refreshing new sensation. All was well until the Iranian Revolution, when I found myself with a new set of problems. Because I spoke English without an accent and was known as Julie, people assumed I was American. This meant that I was often privy to their real feelings about those damn Iranians. It was like having those X-ray glasses that let you see people naked, except that what I was seeing was far uglier than people's underwear. It dawned on me that these people would have probably never invited me to their house had they known me as Firuze. I felt like a fake. When I went to college, I eventually went back to using my real name. All was well until I graduated and started looking for a job. Even though I had graduated with honors from UC Berkeley, I couldn't get a single interview. I was guilty of being a humanities major, but I began to suspect that there was more to my problems. After 3 months of rejections, I added Julie to my resume. Call a coincidence, but the job offer started coming in. Perhaps it's the same kind of coincidence that keeps African Americans from getting cabs in New York. Once I got married, my name became Julie Dumas. I went from having an identifiably ethnic name to having ancestors who wore clogs. My family and non-American friends continued calling me Firuze, while my coworkers and American friends called me Julie. My life became one big knot, especially when friends who knew me as Julie met friends who knew me as Firuze. I felt like those characters in soap operas who have an evil twin. The two, of course, can never be in the same room since they're played by the same person, a struggling actress who wears a wig to play one of the twins and dreams of moving on to bigger and better roles. I couldn't blame my mess on a screenwriter. It was my own doing. I decided to untangle the knot once and for all by going back to my real name. By then, I was a stay-at-home mom, so I really didn't care whether people remembered my name or gave me job interviews. Besides, most of the people I dealt with were in diapers and were in no position to judge. I was also living in Silicon Valley, an area filled with people named Rajiv, Avishai, and Insuk. Every once in a while, though, somebody comes up with a new permutation, and I am once again reminded that I am an immigrant with a foreign name. I recently went to have blood drawn for a physical exam. The waiting room for blood work at our local medical clinic is in the basement of the building, and no matter how early one arrives for an appointment, 40 coughing, wheezing people have gotten there first. Apart from reading Golf Digest and Popular Mechanics, there isn't much to do except guess the number of contagious diseases represented in the windowless room. Every 10 minutes, a name is called, and everyone looks to see which cough matches that name. As I waited patiently, the receptionist called out, "Fritzy! Fritzy!" Everyone looked around, but no one stood up. Usually, if I'm waiting to be called by someone who doesn't know me, I will respond to just about any name starting with an F. Having been called Fruzy, Frizzy, Firucci, and Fruz, and just plain, I am highly accommodating. I did not, however, respond to Fritzy, because there is, as far as I know, no T in my name. The receptionist tried again, "Fritzy, Fritzy, dumbass!" As I stood up to this most linguistically original version of my name, I could feel all eyes upon me. The room was momentarily silent as all of these sick people sat united in a moment of gratitude for their own names. Despite a few exceptions, I have found that Americans are now far more willing to learn new names, just as they're far more willing to try new ethnic foods. Of course, some people just don't like to learn. One mom at my children's school adamantly refused to learn my impossible name and instead settled on calling me F-word. She was recently transferred to New York, where, from what I've heard, she might meet an immigrant or two, and who knows, she just might have to make some room in her spice cabinet. Waterloo. My father is a proud man. He was the first member of his family to study in America, the first to win a Fulbright scholarship, and years later, the first to settle permanently in America. Because of him, his siblings and their families ended up in Southern California, where they all live within half an hour of each other. "I am the Christopher Columbus of the family," he always says. Nothing, however, has made my father as proud as his role as the family swim instructor. In Iran, people learn to swim on their own, if they learned at all. My mother, like most women of her generation, never learned to swim. Neither did four of her five sisters or her brother. This was the norm. My father, always the progressive man, decided that every one of his children and his nieces and nephews would learn to swim. Abadan, having been built by the British, contained many luxuries not readily found in other areas, including a clubhouse with a large pool. Every summer, my relatives came from all over Iran to stay with us, and sure enough, it was always some child's turn to learn to swim. Like a game show host announcing the next contestant, my father would say, "This summer, it's your turn, Mahmoud." My father had a perfect track record, a topic he loved to talk about. "I have a gift," he'd always say. We had all resigned ourselves to having to listen over and over again to his description of the exact moment at which each niece and nephew learned to swim and the spellbinding tension leading up to it. Mahmoud said, "Uncle Kazem, I can't do this." And I said, "Yes, you can." And he lifted his arm like this, and I pushed him a little bit, and he kicked like this, and he started to swim like a fish. So I said, "Hey, you never told me you knew how to swim." He'd always end those riveting tales by telling us, "You should have been there." We were all glad we hadn't been. The stories were interesting the first 14 times, but beyond that, they became the equivalent of the neighbor's vacation slides showing the cathedrals of France from all angles. Unfortunately, there just wasn't much anyone could do to put an end to these tales. Each new swimmer represented a victory, and talking about it made my father relive his moments of glory over and over again. The twinkle in his eye, the excitement in his voice, the pride in his face all made it clear that my father would never stop retelling his stories. History, however, has shown us that even the greatest of generals must eventually face defeat in battle, and thus was carved my destiny. I was my father's Waterloo. My father, an engineer, had an entirely logical approach to teaching his students to swim. In a methodical manner, he would explain all the necessary ingredients in swimming. "Your head goes like this, thus creating buoyancy. Your feet go like this, thus propelling you forward. Your arms go like this to steer you. You put it all together and you've got it." Hearing him explain it made swimming seem as easy as baking a Betty Crocker cake from a mix. You just add water and there you go. The cerebral approach worked on all of my father's swimming students, most of whom, not coincidentally, grew up to be engineers. I, however, needed something else. I've never been interested in why exactly an airplane can fly. I want to know if the pilot has had enough sleep. In learning to swim, I just wanted to know that I wasn't going to die. My father, however, never quite understood the role of anxiety in my fruitless swimming lessons. He eventually decided that perhaps if he yelled or hurled insults, I might learn more quickly. "You're like a rock! You're hopeless! What's wrong with you?" This method may work wonders in the army, but it didn't work with me. I now had two hurdles to overcome: fear of water and fear of being in the water with my father. After a couple summers worth of lessons, I had managed by age 6 to learn nothing, setting an all-time failure record for my father. In hindsight, I believe my ability to dodge all learning opportunities did reveal a certain inner strength, a persistent refusal to be like the others. But the British never appreciated Gandhi's persistence, and my family didn't appreciate mine. My father eventually decided that we didn't actually have to be in a pool for him to get angry with me for not knowing how to swim. He started to have a somewhat Pavlovian reaction toward me. If anybody used the word swim, my father would glare at me with a combination of shame and anger, a look that said, "I wish I had kept the receipt." To save face, he'd come up with a theory of why I couldn't swim. "She's built like a rock," he'd always say. "She just sinks." This wasn't entirely true. I had never actually let go of my father in the pool, preferring instead to cling to him like a koala on a eucalyptus branch during an earthquake. His determination to peel me off himself matched, but did not exceed my determination to hold on to him. Sadly enough, my father stopped talking altogether about his glorious swimming lessons. He knew that no impressive tale could match his one big failure, moi. He finally announced to the world, which for us consisted of my aunts, uncles, and cousins, that some people are incapable of swimming. "Firuze is one of them," he concluded. When I was 8 years old, we went to Switzerland to visit my aunt Parvin, my mother's sister. Aunt Parvin has always been considered something of a deity in our family because she managed, despite being an Iranian woman of her generation, to become a doctor and to set up a successful practice in Geneva. The woman overcame so many hurdles to reach her dream that she deserves to have her likeness carved in marble. The fact that she actually lives in Switzerland further adds to her allure. Iranians have always considered Switzerland the apogee of civilization, a small, clean country where bus drivers don't have to check for tickets since everyone is so genetically honest. Besides, Switzerland has never particularly welcomed Iranians, thus accruing the magnetism that comes only with repeated rejection. Aunt Parvin told my father that she was going to teach me how to swim. My parents decided to leave me with her one afternoon while she worked her medical magic. It didn't occur to them that perhaps they should stay and watch the swimming lesson. My aunt took me to the deep end of the pool, and there, this highly educated woman whom I had grown up worshiping from afar let go of me. I sank. Perhaps because of her medical training, or perhaps because she couldn't face the prospect of having to explain to my parents that she had killed their child, Parvin eventually decided to intervene. Moments before I got to see the tunnel with the light at the end and the angels beckoning me to join them, she lifted me out of the water. My aunt dragged me out of the pool and, doing her best imitation of General Patton in a bad mood, announced that I was hopeless. When my parents joined us, she announced, "Fuse is a rock!" News of my European failure soon reached the rest of my relatives, thus cementing my reputation as the one incapable of swimming. Oddly enough, no one questioned my aunt's method of instruction. She was, after all, a doctor in Switzerland. My near-drowning experience brought with it an unexpected ray of hope, like a wildflower blooming in a battlefield. My family was now completely resigned to my inability to swim. My father no longer insulted me. Instead, he treated me with pity, since he now assumed that I was missing the chromosome necessary for buoyancy. His pity often led to trips to the toy store, thus proving that I was far smarter than my cousins. I managed to acquire 8 new tea sets, while my cousins had merely learned to swim. Most fruits, if left alone on a tree, eventually do ripen, especially if they're not being yelled at. It was thus that I, at the age of 10, decided that I was finally ready to learn to swim. There was, however, one proviso. I wanted to learn to swim in the sea by myself. I proudly made this announcement to my father, who, once he stopped laughing, said, "You never learned to swim in the pool, so now you want to go drown in the ocean?" That summer, we headed for our annual week-long vacation by the Caspian Sea. Because of work commitments, my father was unable to join us. My 2 brothers, my mother, and my Aunt Sedire and Uncle Abdullah and their 4 sons, who knew how to swim courtesy of my father, headed north to the Caspian. Once we arrived, I went straight to the beach. I took a few steps into the water where a gentle wave lifted me, and I started to swim. Simple as that. When we returned to Abadan, I proudly told my father the news. He did not believe me. He and I headed straight for the pool where he watched in disbelief. "You, Firuze," he said, shaking his head, "are an odd child." "No," I said, "there was nobody yelling at me in the sea." Years later, when we moved to Newport Beach, I discovered that one of the greatest joys in life is jumping from a boat into the deep blue Pacific Ocean. That was before I discovered snorkeling in the crystal clear waters of the Bahamas, with sea turtles and manta rays swimming around me. Later still, my husband introduced me to the cerulean waters of the Greek islands, where I spent hours swimming with the hot Mediterranean sun burning on my back. But despite my dips in the many beautiful bodies of water in the world, I have never forgotten that first gentle wave in the Caspian Sea, the one that lifted me and assured me that, yes, the pilot has had enough sleep. America, land of the free. Every Thanksgiving, my extended family and I gather at my cousin Mortaza's house. My mother brings her traditional shrimp curry. My aunt Sedire brings her lima bean rice with lamb shanks. and my Aunt Fatime brings her homemade baklava. All the other relatives prepare their favorite Persian dishes, and we place them next to the stuffed turkey with all the trimmings. Everyone then proceeds to catch up on the latest family gossip, which usually involves rumors of impending marriages. Once all rumors have been spread and subsequently denied by all involved parties, we give thanks.